You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Film historian and biographer Donald Spoto returns to the show this week. He's the author of dozens of great books, including biographies of Alfred Hitchcock, Marilyn Monroe, Joan Crawford, Grace Kelly, Joan of Arc, Ingrid Bergman, Audrey Hepburn, Alan Bates, and so many others. It's impossible to find any recent work on film in which he is not quoted. Donald Spoto, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. I'm delighted to be with you.
You know, usually I would say, and his latest book is, but you've retired from writing. What do you do all day long?
I didn't, frankly, Gary, I didn't retire. I was booted away by circumstances. That is to say, publishers have been, you know, if not shut down, really they're completely inactive due to the health crisis. And apparently what I learned was, Gary, that I wrote the kind of books that publishers believe their readers are no longer interested in. I was told, as a matter of fact, that they're not interested in biographies of creative people. They're not interested in film or theater. They're not interested in this, and they're not interested in that. So I said, well, I'm a man of many interests, and frankly, I don't have to write a book about any particular subject. I'm very happy to be retired. I have many interests to pursue.
And yet, you're quoted in literally every biography I've read in the last few years.
Well, that's very gratifying. If they're favorable comments, I'm very gratified.
Well, let's go back a little and talk about your career, because it's been such a fascinating one. And I think that your book, The Art of Alfred Hitchcock, was really the first to look at the entire output of a single director's work and analyze that work. And I think you published that book in 1975 or 73?
76 was the actual pub date, yes.
So how did you get an idea to write a book that examined Hitchcock's work?
I'm very grateful for that question, Gary, because it's a lovely story and it involves wonderful people. The fact is that on April 29th, 1974, the Lincoln Center Film Society honored Alfred Hitchcock with a Life Achievement Award. And I was living in New York at the time, and I purchased a cheap seat way up in the top balcony at what was then called Avery Fisher Hall, Philharmonic Hall, at Lincoln Center. And I stood outside and watched Hitchcock walk in with Grace Kelly, and I watched Janet Leigh arrive, and Teresa Wright, and Samuel Taylor, the great screenwriter who worked with Hitch and gave us Vertigo, my favorite film of all time. And I bought a ticket, and the fact is, Gary, that all the retrospective movie houses that then existed in New York City were having retrospectives of Hitchcock films all over town during the week and 2 weeks of Hitchcock's arrival and this honor at Lincoln Center. And I went and I saw probably 20 or 25 of these films that I hadn't seen. There were some of them were the silent era Hitchcock, other were the early British sound films, a goodly number of the American pictures. And as I saw these, I began to think, you know, there are recurring themes and situations and motifs and characters in Hitchcock's film, and I decided I would write an article about some of this. So I was teaching university at the time, and I sat down on weekends and holidays, and I started to write this article. But the article turned out to be about 800 pages. So I realized, wait a minute, I have a book here. And I appreciation of every one of Alfred Hitchcock's films. The count is 53. Actually, one is lost, so it's 52 films throughout his entire career. And what happened was that I decided, I was a very bold young man. Well, I wasn't so old, actually. In 1975, when I was in the thick of writing it, I was 36. And I decided, bold as I was, to send some sample chapters of the book to Alfred Hitchcock. And I sent him my chapters on, I hope I'm remembering correctly, oh yes, on Sabotage, 1936, Shadow of a Doubt, 1943, and Frenzy, which was 1972. Then it was his most recent picture. So I sent these off to Hitchcock, never expecting any kind of reply. Well, I got a reply very quickly, and the reply said, would you like to come to Hollywood and watch with me at work in my new picture, which turned out to be Family Plot, his last picture? And I thought, I'll think it over. I thought it over, yes. And I got on a plane, and there I was, spending a month with Hitchcock in July 1975, watching him at work in Family Plot. And you can imagine the thrill that was. That's how the book, it's rather a long-winded reply, that's how that book came to be.
And when you were observing Hitchcock at work, I mean, that must have been gratifying, but what did you see?
I saw a production that was magnificently ordered, quiet, and polite. Of course, he was more than a legend. The actors in the film were in awe of working for him. The crew were chosen for their skill and their ability to hop to it and know, have everything in perfect working order. And that's the kind of set it was. I should also add that Hitchcock was not well in the summer of 75 when he shot the film. He was 75 years old. He turned 76 in August. I mean, he was younger than I am now. I'm going to be 80 in a few months. But he was not well at all. And it was a difficult production. The leading man was fired after they had a lot of film in the can. It was difficult. But that didn't throw any shadow on my delight in watching him at work.
Was it the part which part was the one with the Bruce Dern was playing was fired, or the one that William Devane was playing?
No, it was the one that that William Devane was playing. It was the actor was Roy Finnis.
Oh, uh-huh.
And he and Hitchcock didn't get along, and Hitch did not suffer that gladly, and he fired him. And replaced him with William Devane, who's just fine.
Yeah.
You know, and Bruce was cast in that role from the start because, of course, he had worked for Hitchcock twice before, once for the feature film Marnie, in which he had a very small role, and then he did a Hitchcock television episode.
Right.
So there was no problem. Universal put him through hell in casting that film. The biggest star they had at the time was Liza Minnelli, and they were forcing Liza Minnelli on him. Liza Minnelli. Well, you can't think of an actress who was less Hitchcockian than Liza Minnelli. So he stuck to his guns, and he got, as you know, Barbara Harris.
She was wonderful.
Yes, and Karen Black. It's odd, Gary, that was Hitchcock's most recent film, his last film, and those two ladies, Karen Black and Barbara Harris, are no longer with us,
mm-hmm.
whereas you can go back to films a long time ago, and some of them are still going.
Eva Marie Saint is still with us.
Eva Marie, one of the loveliest people in the business, yes.
I'm going to say she's probably the oldest of Hitchcock's stars.
She is not only the oldest Hitchcock stars, she's the oldest living recipient of an Academy Award.
Oh, yeah.
Which she got, as you know, for On the Waterfront.
She was so great in that. And I wonder how Hitchcock looked at her in On the Waterfront and saw the actress in North by Northwest. They couldn't be more different.
Yeah, I don't know what his assessment was. He needed an elegant blonde, and she was. And also, you know, a prime consideration for Hitchcock was, could he get people cheap? and that was the case. So anyway, there was that. But anyway, the story of how the art of Alfred Hitchcock came to be is very precious to me, because so many people whom I interviewed became really good friends, close friends, in fact. And I say that with great pride and gratitude. It also, I became a good friend to Hitchcock in the 5 years, 6 years remaining in his lifetime.
And when you were watching, you know, tracking down all the films, you saw some of them in revival theaters, but, I mean, there wasn't any video, or how did you find some of the more obscure ones? Did you have to, how did you do it?
Well, I appreciate the question. The fact is, for almost all of the British films, frankly, the British Film Institute was simply wonderful to me. I went to London, spent a month there, and sat in a dark theater alone that they set up for me in Dean Street, and they played for me their vintage vault copies of the Hitchcock movies from the 20s and 30s. I mean, and didn't charge me for it. I felt obliged to make a donation, you know, but it was simply wonderful. I sat there watching these films, which they provided for me as a courtesy. And there's another side to that story, too. I went back to tell Hitch's assistant producer, worked for him for many years, Peggy Robertson. I said I was so thrilled that somehow, and frankly, I don't remember how, I was given a copy, a 16-millimeter copy, of one of Hitch's most loving, most lovely silent films called The Farmer's Wife, based on a play by Eden Philpott. And I just loved that film, and I said, you know, I've got a copy of this, Peggy. Am I not lucky? And she said, you know, Hitch has often mentioned that film with great nostalgia. He hasn't seen it since he made it in 1928. She said, is there any way you could bring that print and come on out to us again and screen it with Hitch? I said, I'll order my plane ticket this afternoon. And I did. I took the film out, and I sat alone with Hitch in his private screening room, and they racked up The Farmer's Wife, and Hitch provided for me a running commentary.
Oh, wow.
All the gossip connected to all the major players in The Farmer's Wife, in addition to mentioning, for example, this shot was done this way, and I did that. So it was thrilling. It was just thrilling.
That's amazing.
So that's how I got to see the film. Also, while VHS was not yet widely commercially available, it had just reached the American shores from Japan. And I happened to know a technician in New York City who was also an admirer of Hitchcock, and he got hold of some of these, and he was transferring them onto VHS for his own pleasure. And he offered me, he said, what do you need? And I said, well, there are a good dozen or so that I haven't seen of it. And he just did it for me. Now, as you know, Gary, there were also 5 Hitchcock pictures to which Hitch himself owned the rights, and they were withdrawn from circulation. They were Rope, Rear Window, Trouble with Harry, The Man Who Knew Too Much, and Vertigo. They were withdrawn. In the 1970s, they were not available. Their television broadcast had expired, and they simply weren't available. However, I knew that every movie and book in the United States has to be registered with the Library of Congress in Washington. And I went down to Washington by train from New York once a week for 5 weeks, and I got to sit at a Steinbeck at the editing table and watch each of these films and take notes and stop and start. So that was another aspect of it. Didn't seem like hard work to me.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Donald Spoto. He's the author of 29 great books, many about film and biographies, including 3 biographies of Alfred Hitchcock.
I think movies, especially the movies that Hitchcock made, were meant to be seen in an audience, you know, with hundreds of other people experiencing it with you. But today, most of us don't do that. I mean, especially now, since there's no movie theaters to go to. What do you think about the difference between the experience of sitting and watching a suspense film by yourself and watching it with hundreds of other people?
Well, you're making an important point. I suppose that the examples that I just gave, sitting alone, for example, in a theater provided by the British Film Institute, and sitting alone in an editing room in Washington at the Library of Congress, I had to make a virtue out of necessity. There were no choices for me. If I wanted to see these films, this is what I had to do. And happily, I hope it worked out. You're right to say that films were made to be seen, you know, by groups of people, an audience, in public, if you will, in a theater. But I have all of the Hitchcock films on DVD or Blu-ray, and I still return to them. I put them on my machine, and I watch them. We watch them here at home, and I don't know. I think it's like being more intimate with good friends.
I was going to ask you if you do that. I mean, I often watch films again and again that I love. I was watching Casablanca, and my wife asked, "Why are you watching this movie when you know every word?" And I said, "Well, there's a lot of songs you know every word. That doesn't mean you don't want to hear them again."
True. I also feel there are films I could name, as you can for yourself, that the fact of the matter is they are so rich. They are either really works of art, or they contain simply great performances, or they simply have deathless dialogue. And the fact of the matter is, you can return to them 5, 10, 20, 30, 40 times. I mean, one would never say to a professor of English, "You mean you're reading Hamlet again? Why are you reading it again?" Because the next time, fresh appreciation and new elements will disclose themselves to you. That's why art does that. It's why we can go back to a museum and look once again at a great painting or statue. It's why we can read a great poem or see a great play in a new production or see the same film. I can tell you I lost count of the number of times I've seen very many Hitchcock films because they disclose fresh elements of greatness each time I see them. And, more to the point, you might say the films don't change, but I've changed. The viewer has changed. Mm-hmm. You have more experience of life. You bring more to these great works than you brought the previous time.
In your analysis of Hitchcock films, you noted lots of symbolic things and subtextual things. Do you think that all of those, do you think, and not just Hitchcock, but do you think an artist always intentionally puts those things, or do you think that whether they're intentional or not, if you see them, then they're there?
The fact of the matter is that when, let's take an example, when Matisse or Monet or Picasso went into their studios with their palettes of paint, they don't stand there saying, "Now, I've used red, and so there on the other side I'm going to use green and blue, and that of course is absolute nonsense. The artist goes into his studio with a full, quiet awareness of his genius and a confidence about what needs to be done to make this potential painting a great work. There's nothing so pretentious as, I'm going to put this here, I'm going to put that there. Their genius is aware of how the work should be structured, how it should be presented. The same thing goes for a great composer. Puccini never said, I can guarantee you, Puccini never said, well, I've done this aria in the key of G major. I should really, for the next act, make sure that I do D minor. Nonsense. They know what they're doing without, without any bogus need to be overly conscious about it. No artist is that conscious. If the creator is that conscious, generally they are sophomores in high school. And I don't say that offensively. They have to begin to work like a sophomore in high school. But when you get the fully realized artist like Alfred Hitchcock or any others in his or her métier, the fact is they know what they're doing. It doesn't have to be forced. It better not be forced. Otherwise, it will come across as so artificial that no audience could stand it.
Well, one of the things that's happening now, as people look at older films, is that they are re-examining those films in light of, our current state of enlightenment. I mean, we know. I was looking the other day at a Pepe Le Pew cartoon, which I still find hilarious, but I could see that if you were a victim of sexual harassment and you were watching a Pepe Le Pew cartoon, your PTSD could really make it a very unpleasant experience. And the whole Me Too era has shed light on the dealings of producers and directors and actors in early Hollywood. And your subsequent books on Hitchcock, you wrote a biography and then another biography, you really reveal some reprehensible treatment of some of the actresses that he worked with. Do you think that should affect the way people view his films?
I certainly hope not. That would be pathetic. People who reject works of art because parts of the artist's life are not pleasant, people who reject those works are asking an artist to be other than human. And in fact, it's the humanity of the creative artist, with all his or her failings and faults, that enables the work to become what it is. Nobody appreciates the level of danger and dread that comes from falling in love the way Alfred Hitchcock presented it to us in virtually every single one of his films. Falling in love is shown to be initially lovely and desirable and something everybody wants to do, and then he shows us, be careful. This is very dangerous. Step cautiously. These works go deeply, and we can respond to them because the artist, in this case Hitchcock, was a flawed and lonely man. I don't think I've ever met, and I have met many people in the arts, many, many people. After 29 books and hundreds of interviews, you get to have quite a list of people you've interviewed and gotten to know. And I don't think I've ever known a lonelier soul than Alfred Hitchcock. He was responsible for that. Well, and who knows in his background how much was too. But the fact of the matter is that I was asked when I was promoting my biography of Hitch on the Today Show, I was asked if, after all the research and the writing, if I still liked and admired him. And I said, more than ever, because he gave us his art at great expense, great, great expense. Hitchcock was not fine. He was a lonely, sad old man, and I don't say that with criticism. I say that with immense compassion.
Well, let's talk about Tippi Hedren for a minute. I had her on this program and spoke with her, and I know you know her well. And she's not exactly fine. I mean, her career was definitely negatively impacted by her. On the other hand, she wouldn't have had a career if Hitchcock had not put her in The Birds and Marnie. But then he kind of, according to her, he completely blackballed her from working in films for 5 years.
Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, one thing you can always count on from Tippi Hedren in speaking with her is the unvarnished absolute truth. She tells it without self-pity, but she tells it honestly and honorably. And when I learned from her the details of her experience with Hitch, I was as horrified as anybody. The amazing thing is, and I've spent a good bit of my career saying this, we have two of the greatest films of Hitchcock's career in The Birds and Marnie. The senior critic for The New Yorkers wrote last year that her performance in Marnie is one of the greatest performances of the 1960s. I've said that for over 50 years, and I'm thrilled when another critic agrees with me. Now, you could say, did it have to be done at such an expense? Well, the fact is, that's what happened. He did not behave well with her, and she wasn't the only one. But it happened, and we have those films that we have, and she's wonderful. And there you are. What upsets me more, believe it or not, is when works themselves are either blacklisted or withdrawn from circulation because they're not politically correct. I can't tell you what rage this evokes for me. Take one example. The brouhaha over Gone with the Wind, because it wasn't made in the 1990s or 2000s and reflected elements of prejudice and of misinformation and misrepresentation of the 1930s, and therefore people don't see the picture. Well, if you don't see the picture, then you are inviting viewers of all ages to say, why are people complaining that black people were not treated so well during the era of slavery? I never saw anything that suggested that. It's very dangerous. Very dangerous.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Donald Spoto. He's a film historian and biographer who's written more than 29 books.
You know, I find Gone with the Wind to be one of the great works of art and a marvelous film. And, you know, personally, I didn't see it as racist, although I did talk to some people who believe it is racist, and their arguments are very strong. Jill Watts, who's the author of a biography of Hattie McDaniel, for instance, said that, you know, when Melody is looking out over the plantation and she says, what a wonderful world you have here, you know, there's no commentary there about how, yes, but it's built on the backs of slavery.
Well, that is true, Gary, but what he might have said additionally is, that is exactly how that character at that time thought and spoke. So it's wonderful that an audience today can say, yeah, but that beautiful society was built on the backs of forgotten, meanly treated slaves. We cannot ask a character in a 19th century story to talk as if they just came from an Equal Rights Amendment meeting. It's ridiculous. In this regard, now let me just pay tribute for a moment to one of the closest friends I had in my life, Olivia de Havilland, who, as you know, left us about 6 months ago. I knew Olivia very well. The last years of her life, I visited with her every couple of weeks. She lived in Paris, as you may know. I live in Denmark. It's only an hour by plane. Olivia and Vivian and Clark Gable were very much aware of what the script treated, what it represented, what it failed to represent. It had to fail to represent it because the society failed. And I just, the worst thing to me about Gone with the Wind is that when the premiere was held, Hattie McDaniel was not allowed to attend it because she was a actress. And when she went to the Oscar dinner, at which she won her Academy Award, she had to sit at a table way over in the back by the kitchen. That's the bad story. That's real-life American prejudice. But in the film, everybody adored working with her. Everybody knew what was up. And if you look just at the scene towards the end, when between Olivia and Hattie, and he comes home, and they're walking up the staircase, it's a huge crane shot, and she's crying the whole way up the stairs. It's one of the great sequences in American film history.
It is it's a beautiful sequence, and Olivia de Havilland is urging Hattie McDaniel to please stop, don't tell me anymore, because you're going to win my Academy Award if you continue on.
But so I come down very hard on this business of, for example, some years ago, there was a big discussion in Germany. There were well-meaning people who said that Hitler's book, Mein Kampf, all copies should be burnt, it should be taken out of circulation. Well, if you do that, then it will be impossible for people to say anything except, what was so bad about Hitler? He never said anything terrible. You keep that book in print, and you see that what this man wrote and how he thought was dreadful to the point of inhumanity. And you have historians, and you have students read it and watch the color drain from their faces. This business of, not permitting these things to be,
Well, let's take a film like Birth of a Nation. Now, I don't find anything racist about Gone with the Wind, but Birth of a Nation tells a story of these helpless whites being oppressed by the evil Negroes, and fortunately the Ku Klux Klan ride to the rescue. That's a kind of a different, that's a truly racist film. And in fact, all of the African American parts were played by white actors in blackface in the picture. Do you think that's a different situation, or that film should still be seen and praised as a work of art?
I think both. I think it should be praised for its editing and its rhythmic storytelling, but you have to be able to point out exactly what you said. It is a racist document. It's the same situation you have with Leni Riefenstahl, the German director in the 30s, who gave us The Triumph of the Will and Olympia, the two great pictures for which she became the darling of the Nazi film industry. Now, Triumph of the Will is a terrifying presentation of Nazi ideology. Should it all copies be burned? No way! Otherwise nobody knows what was popularized, what was commissioned, and what people thought was great. The footnote, of course, is that as a piece of filmmaking, it's also brilliant. So I think it should be shown in the classrooms, shown in the theaters, and spark discussion. I really deplore that a work can be great and have reprehensible ideas embedded in it. It can. Yes, just like the artists. In my introduction to my third Hitchcock book, which is Spellbound by Beauty, Alfred Hitchcock and His Leading Ladies, I make the point that we can all name artists who were pretty terrible on the scale of human estimation, but who left us great works. We've discussed Hitchcock already. Picasso mean, he treated everybody badly, especially every woman whose shadow crossed his path. Richard Wagner, where would we be without those great works of music and operatic stage? However, he was a reprehensible human being. He cheated his own mother out of her pension in order to finance one of his operas. He treated people, and he was a confirmed, busy anti-Semite. But we would be very poor if we didn't have his works. The works don't glorify that. That's his private life. That's what he did. But we better be very sure that we don't start judging works of art by the character of the artist. We're going to be in great trouble. We expect them to be angels and saints, and they're not.
When I look at your bibliography of all the wonderful books you've written, they seem to kind of follow naturally one after the other. That is, you wrote a book about Hitchcock, and then you wrote about many of his co-stars. What led you from one book to the next? Was there a theme?
No, I can't say there was, or at least I have no recollection of there being so, Gary. For example, just a few examples. I met a person who was very, very connected to, very well connected to the estate of Marilyn Monroe, and told me, you know, there are all these recordings that were made with her that nobody has ever heard. You really should take a listen to them. Old Dick DeBelt recordings. So I did, and I began to realize that the Marilyn Monroe everybody thought they knew never existed, that she was nothing like the myth. The day that Laurence Olivier died, it just so happened that I had already interviewed a who worked with him on a number of his projects. And my phone rang for half a day from these good people who said, you're just the one to do this. You really should do this. And my reaction was, the English are never going to cooperate with an American for a book on our Larry. Well, I was wrong. I made a few calls, and very soon I was living in London for the better part of a year, and it was a glorious enterprise, a glorious project to have. But I can't say there was a theme that I had in mind that I wanted to pursue from book to book. No, in the case of Olivier, he had just died. No biographer was working on a book, and I gave you the example of what happened with Monroe. There's a story about each one, but I didn't have an agenda that I wanted to bring to the creation of every book, no.
Were there people that you wanted to write about that, publishers said, no, nobody wants to read that, and therefore you didn't get a chance to write about?
Oh, sure. I mean, as I mentioned early in our conversation, I am a man of many interests. The problem today, of course, is publishing worldwide is in a perfectly dreadful condition. I mean, you know this from, look at the films that are made. They're generally made by teenagers, for teenagers, starring films, teenagers. There are the exceptions. Along comes a great talent like the recently deceased Christopher Plummer, and you get something different. But my experience in the last years of my writing books was that people in film and theater had reached such a level of disgust that they were all quitting, too. I mean, how many more movies can you have about teenage vampires? How many more films depend on another car crash? How many more films have such utter lack of imagination that romance and sex means a squeaky mattress, whereas take a film like Hitchcock's masterwork, one of his masterworks, Notorious, with Ingrid Bergman and Cary Grant, and they never remove a sweater, or a jacket, and the passion between them almost fizzles the dimensions of the movie screen.
They talk a lot while they're kissing.
And, yeah, and the fact is that this is a film made by adults, with adults, and for adults. And boy, am I way my age when I talk this way, and I just don't care. But the quality of the writing, the quality of the acting, are there people out, let's be specific. Yes, there were people I would like to have written about. Two friends in the movie, in filmmaking specifically, were my two great friends, François Truffaut, the French director, and Federico Fellini, the great Italian master of the cinema. I knew them both. They were great friends of mine, and I would love to have done their biographies. You couldn't pay a publisher to publish a book on them. In terms of actors, yes, there were a number of actors I wanted to. John Gielgud was a great friend to me and demonstrated that when he endorsed my Olivier book so generously. And I said to him afterwards that I would consider it an honor if he would think of me as possibly his authorized biographer. He said, "I'd like nothing better, but I've already given the rights to somebody who's going to wait till I'm dead to publish it." And that's exactly what happened. So there are a few names, and there also were American actresses who I think had fascinating lives and interesting people in their own right that I would love to have written about. And sorry, but the publishers say who? All the publishers in the last 15 years sound like a chorus of owls. You would say, you know, how about a biography of my great friend Olivia de Havilland, who, by the way, appointed me her authorized biographer. And they said, it sounded like a chorus of owls. They would say, who? You believe that? I'm telling you the absolute truth. They asked, nobody knew. I could name 10 publishers. They didn't know who Olivia de Havilland was. Or they said, oh, wasn't she in Gone with the Wind? Yeah, a friend of mine saw Gone with the Wind.
Oh, my God.
We're talking about American publishing. And there are others, you know, that I could name. But I'm from I come from a different era. Like somebody said, why don't you do a biography of they mentioned a pop singer whose name I forget right now, big star, and I said, because it doesn't interest me, it's not my era, it's not my time, and she's too young. Hasn't had a life, you know.
Well, Donald Spoto, you have brought to life so many people on the page, and I've loved all of your books, and I've also cherished all the conversations we've had here on From the Bookshelf, including this one. Thanks so much for spending some time with us this week.
It's always a pleasure, Gary. Always a pleasure. I hope this won't be the last time.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.